The Montville United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland, starts at 7 p.m. this evening. Thank you, John, Reggie, and Becky. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bridges Cafe and Catering, located at 2716 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Bridges Cafe and Catering is a restaurant and catering company located in Northeast Portland on the corner of MLK and Northeast Knott Street. Their kitchen is about 75% organic, open daily. Lunch was provided by Por Que No Taqueria, located in North Portland at 3524 North Mississippi Ave. Por Que No Taqueria has been serving Portland since 2005 and has been committed to both the communities and the food that they serve. More information online at porquenotacos.com. Dinner was provided by Scotty's Pizza Parlor, located at 2128 Southeast Division Street in the Hosford Abernethy neighborhood of Portland. Serving pizza, desserts, and more, Scotty's is open every day from 11:30 to 9 p.m. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm/give right now.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01, and we are in the midst of our holiday membership drive, and your heart will grow three sizes if you contribute right now to our holiday membership drive. 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO, or go online, kboo.fm. And now a special show. It's Between the Covers.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Chelsea Hodson. Hodson is the author of the much-talked-about chapbook Pity the Animal, a book Maggie Nelson called wild and chiseled and Molly Crabapple described as small and sharp as a dagger. Originally published in a sold-out run with Future Tense Books, Pity the Animal was later republished as an Emily Books pick. Hodson's writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Black Warrior Review, Hobart, Freeze Magazine, and elsewhere. She's a graduate of the Bennington College MFA program and has been awarded fellowships from McDowell and Penn Center USA Emerging Voices. She has collaborated with the Marina Abramovich Institute's digital journal Immaterial, as well as assisting with Abramovich's installation Generator. Hodson is the creator of Inventory, an online image text project that spanned 657 days, where she cataloged and posed with each object that she owned one by one, as well as Inventory Under Objects under a 7-hour durational performance of Inventory that was filmed, live streamed, and archived by the Marina Abramovich Institute. Chelsea Hodson teaches writing at Catapult in New York City and at Mors Tua Vita Mea in Rome, and is here today to talk about her essay collection, Tonight I'm Someone Else, just out by Henry Holt and Company. Sarah Manguso says of Tonight I'm Someone Else, Chelsea Hodson tests herself against her desires, grapples with their consequences, and presents a surgically precise account of what they were to her. These essays are bewitching. Despite their discipline and rigor, you can smell the blood. Miranda July adds, Hodson's essays have such a sexy drama to them, and ultimately it's the romance of just getting through life, the passion that comes from being a wholly alert woman and living to tell about it. Atticus Lish adds that Hodson's essays are a specialized art form where poetry meets philosophy. They reflect on the gruesome side of being a woman in the excellent tradition of Joan Didion and Sylvia Plath. Finally, Booklist calls Tonight I'm Someone Else a unique collection about being an artist and a woman in a world that doesn't always value either. Welcome to Between the Covers, Chelsea Hodson.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start with the title, Tonight I'm Someone Else. I feel like it's a perfect title, and yet a strange one, since we're talking about nonfiction rather than fiction, that you're writing as yourself. So how did you land on this title?
Yeah, it took a long time. It came very late, actually, too. So I am someone that's excited by titles. So I have, I need a title to work with, generally. So an essay or a bigger project usually doesn't last very long without a title. Like, I eventually add something to it, and I'll usually change that much later, or just change it multiple times. So with this book, I just kept calling it different titles of the essays. And then at one point I was calling it Awful Form, which was a quote from the book of a reference to the awful forms of love. Mm. And I liked that idea of just how love and desire can change or shape a person. And I think from having that title in my head, I was able to then see the phrase "Tonight I'm Someone Else," which appears in another one of the essays, and see that as a potential title. So I don't have an essay called that, but once I saw that phrase, I thought, actually, that is better, I think. Mm. So I was able to identify that, and once I was applying that to each essay, it really worked for me. I felt like each essay fed into that title in some way, and it helped maybe the reader come to the book in a different way than my previous titles had. But I went through probably like 50 titles.
Oh, wow.
Before I came to even Awful Form.
Yeah, that's a lot of titles.
Yeah.
Well, you've said that after seeing the documentary about J.T. Leroy called Author, that you've been fascinated by the role and function of persona in nonfiction.
Yeah.
A genre that I think most casual readers would probably assume doesn't involve personas at all. For those who don't know the story of J.T. Leroy, could you orient us to that story a little bit, to that strange literary tale, and then the ways in which your meditation on it relates to this idea of persona and nonfiction?
Yeah. I wasn't old enough to be reading those books at the time when that scandal was happening, so I only learned about it much like in the past couple of years, and then when the documentary came out, I became really fascinated by this idea of an author who understood maybe that the culture wouldn't understand or respect her and her image, and so she took on this persona where she hired her boyfriend's sister, it was, I believe, to perform as her and dress as her. And so it just became this other self. So even though she was writing everything, there was this very performative side of the writing that no one was even aware of.
And in the writing itself, she's claiming to be someone other than who she is,
we should say. Yes, yes. So like I said, like I don't even have the story totally straight. I've seen the documentary, and like I understand you know, the idea of this performance and the visuals of it are really what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I'm not like even remembering all the details of the story correctly, because I just love in the documentary this the author who doesn't look the way that people wanted her to look. So she found someone and dressed them the way that she thought people would understand the story she was writing.
Yeah.
Well, and I really like that visual of this other physical self.
The part about the author breaking the contract with the reader around what is expected around memoir. So creating a new identity, saying that she's a completely different sort of person, actually plays a big role. And I'm thinking of Vivian Gornick's book, The Situation of the Story, where she argues that sometimes the reason a nonfiction piece can take so long to write is because you're still trying to figure out what voice it is or what the persona is of the narrator, even though the narrator is in a sense also you,
mm-hmm.
But that it's a more constructed and stable version of the writer, that you're writing from a certain vantage point in time, under the spell of a given mood, even if the writer isn't in that space that they've created the static part about. But I feel like your project isn't that project. And I just want to reflect what I feel and then see what you think. But you're not trying to fool the reader, but I also don't feel like you're trying to create a persona as much as the book seems to be about the experience of adopting personas,
mm-hmm.
Even the social politics of what it means to assume a persona, almost as if you're looking at your own life as an act of art making or performance, kind of like maybe that's why your fascination is with this actor that shows up in the
yes.
world and plays this writer. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that sort of vantage point on the book. And then maybe you could just talk a little bit more about this fascination with persona.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that you don't, that you see, or I forget how you phrased it, of just that you see the book is interested in these other selves, but not, how did you phrase it? Like as
well, like if we think of Gornick's view that you're constructing a persona that is going to carry someone through the book, but in a way it feels like instead of you creating a static persona, the book is about the multiplicity of personas that a person could assume.
Right.
I mean, there is a through line. It's you writing and we get the motifs that reoccur, but it also feels like there's this disappearance of self into circumstance or disappearance of self into other selves.
Yeah. I think my writing voice is, you know, just like any voice is constructed and intentional and perhaps performative, but I don't see it as really changing from essay to essay. It's more of like, I think of it as a document of who I was at that time. And inevitably that, you know, like the feelings or vantage point changes based on the time in my life or the mood of that scene or the location. I see these things as influencing the self and kind of beyond a performative sense of just like, I'm interested in essays and nonfiction because I like this idea of being bound to what I remember. But that already seems so, I don't know, almost like transitory, or I often think of, you know, memories as dreams. I think that it's interesting to think of memories and quote truth as a boundary and a restriction when those things don't even seem concrete to me. So I like kind of flirting with that idea and kind of dancing around it. And I guess persona comes into play with that of like, how do you maneuver through something that you're not sure you remember correctly?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that requires this element of a constructed voice or a voice that is trying to make art out of one's life.
This theme of persona, do you feel like that's more honest in a way? Like when we're talking about truth, to sort of expose like the slippery slope of what really is truth and putting that forward?
Yeah, or maybe this idea that like no matter who you think you are, you really are just one self, you know, or like that there's all these different vantage points you can have and all these different parts of yourself, but that ultimately it's me writing the book. And I kind of accept that. You know, of just like putting my name on the front and this idea of like tonight I'm someone else, but then the disappointment that you actually aren't, like you're always just yourself.
So would that put you in the camp or in a different camp from Eileen Miles, who would say that, or at least in our conversation, she was talking about identity really just being the accumulation or layering of gestures.
Mm. Yeah, I've never thought of it that way. I think that in writing the book, I've kind of more fully formed my idea or my notion of these like different aspects of the self. And for me, it's like I can look at certain essays and actually not recognize myself in them. And there's something really mysterious about that to me, where it's almost as if someone else lived them. But I think ultimately it comes back to a kind of almost existential sadness of like, it's me. It's always me. And there's no escaping that. And yeah. I think that's part of like the human condition. And that's why I'm interested in reading people's documents of their own lives. You know, like I love novels, I love poetry, but I think I wanted to write this kind of book for that reason.
Hmm. Well, I do think one of the compelling aspects of the book is watching you perform your life, like creating art as you make these choices or allow others to make choices for you. And part of why I think it's compelling is that the avatar for you in the book seems to almost court mistakes, to court life's mistakes as if they're not only the most interesting moments, but maybe the most important moments. And this persona across essays also does not feel like she's full of regrets. She doesn't lament. There's not a lot of rumination that happens after an action. And I guess I wanted to just ask first, with this issue of persona and truth, whatever that is, do you think we would recognize this in you? If we were your friend down the hall, a woman who relishes in her mistakes without regrets, or is this sort of an on the page intensification or performance of something that may be somewhat real, but has a lot of countervailing aspects to it?
Yeah. It's interesting that you're framing it as like someone that knows me or lives down the hall. Because I think that that person wouldn't recognize it because I'm so private. So I find writing a space to express this kind of thing and ruminate somewhat, even though I don't do it for extended pages at a time or extended periods of time, I think. But I'm someone that I think studying Stoicism for a little bit, like just reading certain books by Seneca or Marcus Aurelius, have really helped me put the events of my life into some sense of order, and that an acceptance of like, I actually don't, you know, I don't stay up at night thinking like, oh gosh, I wish I would never have done that. So of course I have regrets of my life, but it's not something that consumes me. And by writing about them, I think I'm able to make more sense of them. And there's a line in my book where it's like, I think mistakes are imprinted in our DNA. It's only a matter of time before we make them. So that's something that I believe. I think certain people are drawn to certain things. And so I believe that maybe by being drawn to certain situations and having the courage to act in them, whether it's right or wrong, that in a way has canceled that out for me. That then I no longer have to engage in that behavior. Like that it's something that I had to go through. But if I can see it that way, then I don't really have a sadness about it. Hmm. It's more of like, I'm at peace with it and I accept it as part of my life.
So is there something particular about the Stoics that gives you this sense?
Of just accepting, just basically accepting one's life and not thinking that one deserves more than someone else. Like, for instance, more happiness. Mm-hmm. I'm not someone that wishes like, oh, I wish I were so happy. Like, I don't really believe in that. So yeah. I think that's something that they taught me of like, no matter how much money you have or how much, quote, happiness you have, ultimately you're still stuck with yourself, essentially. And that's not, that doesn't have to be torture. It's just something, it's just how we live, I think.
Yeah.
So I think in reading that and realizing that they're 2,000-year-old texts, there's something that I just thought, okay, well, that's just how humans are. No matter what the politics are, what the technology is like, it's like I see myself in those texts, and I think that informed a lot for me.
So you've talked about your aim in the essay is to portray more than to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
That you cross out phrases that you are where you are looking back at something you've done because you want to preserve the heat of the event themselves. So I was hoping you could unpack that a little. What are you hoping to achieve with that? And what does having the reflection and the looking back and the rumination in the text itself do that you don't like?
I'm interested in playing with the prose in a way that makes it have more heat, makes it feel closer to the reader. And I think there's an inevitable distance that comes up when you can sense the writer there in the safe place looking back. I'm more interested in like the moment when things are totally uncertain and unsafe and kind of chaotic.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio here on our holiday membership drive. And right now is the time we're asking you to support this station. It's funded by our listeners. We need you to call the number 877-500-5266. Go to kboo.fm. If you are not wanting to pick up your phone, you can also stop on by. We've had some people come by this morning. 20 Southeast 8th is where we're at. And we would be happy to see you and show you around our palatial studios, and you can see where this radio station operates. This is a radio station that is a place where actual humans from your neighborhood sit down in discussion with other humans from your neighborhood or with local city or state officials, or as in this case, an author. Writers and authors seek us out. Independent authors and publishers seek out KBOO for a space. This Between the Covers that you're listening to is an award-winning podcast internationally. It's won awards in England. It's won awards here in the U.S., and that's done here in the KBOO studios. David Naiman puts together this show for you, and I appreciate the fact that he is doing that as a volunteer. And now we're asking for you to call and support this station. $5 a month is a great amount to start with. If you've never given to community radio before, you can cancel at any time, and you get a special prize, a KBOO beanie, a KBOO black cap. That is perfect for this weather. I'm wearing mine right now. Or you can get a Music Makes the Movement tote bag. We want to thank Lisa and Jane. And we want to thank Trent and Paul. Thank you all for joining in the last few minutes. And we are waiting for the phone to ring right now for you to become a member as well. We need you to make a conscious choice. Divest from the fossil fuel economy. Divest from corporate Wall Street casino economy. And invest in something solid, wholesome, true, genuine. Your community radio station, where you're listening to David Naiman talking about persona in nonfiction, the performative aspects of writing, authors breaking the contract with the reader and breaking out of the mold. This is real conversation that's happening here on KBOO. And I know that people appreciate that we have these in-depth, commercial-free conversations on a daily basis that are done by volunteers right here in your community. The reason we're able to do that and the way we're able to do that is because we have community support. So we need you to step up right now and pledge your $5 a month to support this community effort. 877-500-5266. If you heard me yesterday, I want to leave this on the table that there is still two times a drive Amy Goodman provides for us. $2,000 donor will get to have dinner with her and a studio tour and watch the filming of Democracy Now in New York City. So if you have a $2,000 and you're able to make that kind of contribution, you could do that as well. Give us a call. Set that up. You do it at your convenience, 877-500-5266. That's the lifeline for KBOO, for democracy on the airwaves, for a space where people can have these types of in-depth conversations consciously, deeply, and in the way that really makes an impact. So call, make an impact with your call and your $5 or $10 a month. Call right now, 877-500-5266.
You know, there's parts of my life that I wanted to write about, but I don't remember. So there's a part in one of the essays where I just list, I don't remember blank, I don't remember blank, I don't remember blank. And that's obviously written from a vantage point in which the event is very far away. So I think there's a way to combine both that's maybe satisfying for the reader, but I'm not really interested in writing a whole like 300-page memoir from my vantage point now where I'm looking back at my life. Mm-hmm. I like to kind of play with the words and the tenses to make it feel like I'm still in that moment, because that helped me write it and helped me remember things. So it's basically a writing technique for me as well.
Hmm. Could we hear Near Miss?
Oh, yeah, sure. Near Miss. And it starts with a quote by Roland Barthes, A Lover's Discourse, which says, "Waiting is an enchantment. I have received orders not to move." "Do you want to play?" Sam asked, using a jump rope to tie a butcher knife to his ceiling fan. His invented game had a name I no longer recall, but I looked at Julian, sitting on the couch, then back at Sam, standing barefoot on his coffee table, and I said, "Sure." It seemed like the type of thing that might occur more naturally at night, after a few drinks, but this was a Saturday afternoon, and the three of us hadn't even had coffee yet. Sam's house was alongside a dirt road in Tucson, near the University of Arizona, where I hoped to study journalism. I'd seen Sam sing at a basement show a few months prior and had fallen in love with the drummer, Julian, but called him something less suspicious, my friend. I'd borrowed my mother's minivan to drive the 2 hours from Phoenix to spend the day with them. Sam tightened the knot around the butcher knife's handle as I took my seat next to Julian on the couch. "Are you ready?" Sam asked, and I said, "No," but he pulled the fan's metal chain and rushed to his seat. "Keep your hands on the couch," he said. "That's the rule." Arms at our sides, we watched as the knife picked up speed and the rope became stiff, pointing at us like an accusation. I averted my gaze from the knife to Julian, and, for a moment, I thought he might look back. The knife seemed like a kind of placeholder, an object standing in for the badness of the world, which had not yet reached us, not all the way. We brought it closer. Schopenhauer wrote, "The scenes of our life resemble pictures in rough mosaic. They are ineffective from close up, and have to be viewed from a distance if they are to seem beautiful." He argued that attaining a goal was beside the point. It's the ad interim which makes up our lives, that time leading up to the thing we thought we wanted. The summer in between high school and college seemed disposable, and I woke up each day ready to waste it. I regarded college as the moment my life would finally begin. I wasn't ready. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't in love enough. But time slowed as the knife made lap after lap, pointed toward our foreheads. Julian had said we should make it the best summer ever, and maybe this was that. I couldn't tell. I expected Julian to love me back. I expected to acquire him, as in the object of my affection, a phrase I've always hated for its implication of ownership. It's a lie designed to give hope. Someday, perhaps I would hold him in my hands and keep him forever. However, never having him might have been just as useful. Schopenhauer, "To attain something desired is to discover how vain it is." I hoped for the end result, even though I couldn't define it, because I thought it was the only important thing. I'd been taught that all those days before I got what I wanted were hours to be hurried, not valued. We weren't sure how tightly the rope held the knife, if it would slip, when. I think it glittered each time it passed the sun in the window, but perhaps it only glitters now when I try to see it again. Laughter, destruction, injury, love, listing them here, they appear distinct, as separate entities, but that's not right. The time in which we waited, that was the great equalizer, in which one consequence replaced another. Anything could happen, so, for a moment, everything did. Then the fan's blades turned at top speed, and the knife slipped and darted toward my love, I mean my friend, and missed him by a few inches, stabbed the couch cushion instead. We gasped, said, "Oh my God," and covered our mouths with our hands. We couldn't stop laughing at how close we'd been. I ached for so many things then. I thought I could still feel my bones growing some nights, the way I did when I was a child. I longed for the future, as if it would arrive in a clearly labeled box just for me, as if I could open it in midair as it hurled itself toward my shoulder. I failed to value its obscurity then, and I'm still failing, even now. The inevitability of the knife simplified everything. Each anatomy was available to ruin. Each law was breakable. That's what made the world so beautiful, so seemingly new within its impossible history. I forgot that sometimes.
Hello, good morning. I'm Brianna, and I'm here with...
I'm Ed Jinka, and we're here for our holiday membership drive.
That's right. If you didn't know, KBOO is funded by you, our listeners, so we're asking you to go to the phone right now and dial 877-500-5266, or go to kboo.fm and become a member today.
You know, you're listening to this discussion on Between the Covers. It's very compelling, deep discussion with the authors of the books that are being talked about. Here at KBOO, we have a philosophy of radical inclusion. We have a philosophy that means there's a show for everyone. KBOO challenges you by introducing you to ideas and musics that you've never heard, never been introduced to. When you support KBOO, you support all the people making it happen, a strong infrastructure for the next generation of media makers. Don't take independent media on your airwaves for granted. KBOO is here because of listener support. And this is one of the few times a year that we break into the programming to ask for your support. And you always come through. And I really appreciate that. I appreciate all the people that have called this morning. This is the time for you to call. If you've never called community radio station before, do it right now, and you will find it is well worth it. First, you become a member. Maybe you're doing a $20 a month contribution, and you're contributing to your community radio station that way. Then you find that you can come into volunteer orientation. Next thing you know, you have a show, and you're on the air, and you're part of this station. Be part of this family right now. 877-500-5266, or stop on by and say hello. We're at 20 Southeast 8th. We'd love to see you and share some coffee and show you around the studios. 20 Southeast 8th. Make your contribution that way. I would urge you, if you can, a $25 a month contribution goes such a long way, and you get to sport the KBOO hoodie. If you wear that around town, people will know, and you will be able to represent your community radio station a really, really wonderful and substantial way.
And I love what you had to say, Jinka, about how we have programming for everyone. We really try to make sure that diverse communities are here and given space on the air. And as a person who's usually a late night programmer, having the opportunity to listen to shows like Between the Covers in the morning is such a refreshing change to my routine. And I'm so thankful for everyone who takes the time to do their research and contact these incredible authors and actually give us this incredible content to listen to. So if you, like me, like that kind of refreshing new information that you don't have to find yourself, all you have to do is tune in to KBOO. Call 877-500-5266. You can give a one-time donation today, or you can become a sustaining member. And for only $5 a month, you could have a KBOO tote bag. And let me tell you, this tote bag carries a lot. As a person who carries a lot on a regular basis, I love this tote bag. 877-500-5266, or go to kboo.fm and make a donation today.
You know, I so appreciate our listeners. You tune into KBOO and you make the effort to actually find this station, to find this 90.7 or KBOO.fm, and to listen and to get informed and to get involved in your civic duty, really, of listening and getting connected to the issues that matter. And now we're just wanting you to complete that circle and be a member of this community by calling 877-500-5266. $5 a month is a great amount. You could also do a one-time contribution. Anyone who gives $10 or more will be entered into contests and be a part of this Willamette Week Give Guide that we are a part of. We're trying to raise the funds to support KBOO, and we're asking for you to be a part of that. You use KBOO maybe on a regular basis, or maybe you just discovered KBOO. So now is the time to support KBOO and to ensure that this democracy on the airwaves continues. 877-500-5266.
We've been listening to Chelsea Hodson read from her essay collection, Tonight I'm Someone Else. So this willingness to drift toward bad decisions or dangerous decisions, it seems to manifest in the essay collection as a sort of dislocation of self or an absenting from self and the concerns of self and a disappearance into the flow of a situation being carried by the strength of someone else's agenda.
Yeah.
At various points in the book, you say things like, I love to be convinced, to be guided into feeling exactly what the speaker wants me to feel. And in interviews, you've talked about how you wanted to explore why you felt drawn to certain situations, which involved giving up all your power, intellectual power, physical power, and sexual power. And I wanted to bring Marina Abramović into the conversation, not only because of your relationship to her work, but because of some of the thematic resonances. And I was hoping we could start with you describing Rhythm Zero for people, her most famous piece, I think, from the 70s.
Yes.
Could you tell people who don't know what this performance art piece was, what happened?
Yes, there's a series of objects laid on the table. And then for 6 hours, she, in her performance proposal, she stated, I am the object, I take full responsibility, I think. So, I think because I'm paraphrasing, but she accepted the role of the audience in the performance, in that all the objects, including a loaded gun, were on the table, and she was willing to do whatever, including die, I believe, you know, because people literally had a loaded gun up to her neck at one point, and she didn't move. I mean, she was totally committed to this idea of an experiment, almost. That's what I really like about her work, is that you never really know what's going to happen because it involves other people. And through that, it has this sense of danger and submission on her part, where she submits to the idea that anything could happen.
So her phrase, I am the object, during this period, I take full responsibility. And then in your piece, Pity the Animal, you speak about Abramović and say, taking responsibility is another way of forgiving someone else for their possible actions. Marina doesn't have responsibility. She takes it before reducing herself to a body. And that's really interesting, this emphasis on the word take, that there's this act of agency,
yeah,
towards objectifying oneself,
mm-hmm,
and seeing what evolves out of that.
Yeah.
It was fascinating to me partially because she's sort of forgiving the audience in advance, taking the responsibility, dislocating her own like self-narrative from her body, and then people cut her clothes, people stick thorns in her, people aim a gun at her head. But one of the things that is remarkable is that her final act is sort of the exact opposite of the whole piece, mm-hmm, which is her stepping forward.
Mm-hmm.
So after these 6 hours of being an object, she simply walks toward the audience, and
yeah,
everyone runs away as,
yeah,
if there's like some sort of restoration of responsibility,
yeah,
just by her moving. And
the confrontation of coming toward them, right?
You know, yeah,
like,
I mean,
that's
without,
like, that's all that she needed to do.
Right, was to act.
Yeah.
To and then essentially they're running from what they've projected on her that's really theirs.
Yeah, exactly.
It reminds me sort of this, I mean, the whole idea of the scapegoat comes from a Yom Kippur ritual in 2,000 years ago when you,
right,
would place the,
yeah,
sins of the community on a goat and then chase it out into the desert.
Right.
But it would be what would happen if the goat ran back into the city.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. And I think there's such a power in her not saying anything at that point. It's like, it's not like she was like, no, stop. Like, that would actually be much weaker or gentler almost than just silently stepping forward. And it's that kind of simplicity that I try to enact in my writing with like a small gesture or something that means a lot more than you might think, or than like a really violent action or really dramatic scene would enact. It's really like one hand touching another hand is, to me, like really just has so much power. And so it's that kind of simplicity that I think in observing her work has really helped me in my writing, of just thinking about the physicality of one body.
Thinking about the different ways the objectification and commodification of the body, particularly the female body, shows up in this collection. Your examination of your work as a model, working at American Apparel, where they wanted you to sell clothes in a bikini, and then your flirtation with a site called Seeking Arrangements.
Yeah.
So I was hoping you could talk about Seeking Arrangements, and then maybe speak a little more about, do you feel like as you explore this, the ways in which you, if you do, you step it toward the audience in an essay, the way she steps towards the audience at the end of her piece?
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I think the first thing that comes to mind of stepping toward the audience is like kind of making sense of something that seemed confusing or even taboo to myself. So this act of like confessing, which is what happened in Pity the Animal, which is the first essay in the book that I wrote, because it was released earlier, and then I decided to include it in this collection. And that came as a desire to find the distinction between a human, an animal, and an object. I started to, I think through viewing Marina Abramović's piece, The Artist is Present, in which she just sat in a room at MoMA, gazing at someone for 8 hours a day, like the visitors could cycle through. And so the piece was just her in a room. I was very curious about this, and so I went to see it, very skeptical about it. I wasn't like, this is going to change my life, I'm going to go see it. I was like, what is this about? And I never heard of her when I went there. And I felt the presence of her, and the intensity of the action was generating its own energy in the room. And
Essentially it's a not doing that's yes. generating this energy.
Well, the doing is simply unwavering eye contact. That really fascinated me. And it scared me so much that I write in the book about that I couldn't, I had my chance to like stand in line, sit in front of her, and I actually didn't want to engage, which is, I think, very true to my personality. Like, mm-hmm. I'm really drawn to these people that engage or that challenge things. And I'm someone that is usually content watching someone else do something. So, in that, I'm interested in, I think that's where Seeking Arrangement comes into play, of like, I was interested in it as almost a performance.
Well, can you tell people what it is?
Sure. First? Yeah. So Seeking Arrangement, as I write in the book, is a site that where you can have a profile as a sugar daddy or a sugar baby, which means as a woman, you would be this young, attractive woman, and then you list a price that would be like your rate to be the girlfriend or to be the woman in the rich, usually older gentleman's life. So you kind of use this site to work around this taboo idea, and you just accept that everyone on the site is down with this exchange. And the site, you know, advertises itself as having mutually beneficial arrangements. The guy gets what he wants, the girl gets what she wants, and usually, from what I understand, sex is involved, but it's not automatic. That's not the only thing. So I write in the book that it's somewhat of a loophole for prostitution, it seems, because it presents itself as being more dignified, like that it's civilized, and yet the rules seem pretty much the same to me. But there were also people on the site that genuinely didn't seem to want that. It was more of either like a power exchange or something about like appearing with a younger woman. Like there was all kinds of different people on the site. I was getting by. I wasn't like so desperate that I was doing it, but there was something else in my psyche that was drawing me to kind of flirt with this idea of almost danger. I was excited by it, but it ended up being something that I could use for my art. And that ended up being all that it needed to be. I never went back on the site.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Between the Covers. You're listening on our holiday membership drive. This is day two of our holiday membership drive, and we are only going till Saturday. Now is the time to support your community radio station. We need you to call 877-500-5266 and become a member or renew your membership. My name is Jenka, and I am here with Brianna. We're excited to be here on Between the Covers to share with you why it is important to support KBOO right now.
Absolutely. I got to tell you that listening in on this and hearing about a story that is so emotionally impactful in the idea of having everything on the line, being willing to sacrifice your life, essentially, is a very, it's very heavy and beautiful at the same time. And it's I am so happy to be able to be listening to it. And I hope that you are happy to be listening to it also here on KBOO. And if you are listening to it and you've never called us before, I encourage you to flirt with danger. Pick up your phone, call 877-500-5266. And there are volunteers here waiting to talk to you, to get to know you, and to let you know more about how you can support KBOO right now. If you are already a member, we encourage you to call in and reevaluate how much you can give. Bump up your monthly donation by a dollar or two. That helps the station stay thriving. 877-500-5266 is the number to call. You can also come on in and see for yourself what your community radio station looks like. You can walk into 20 Southeast 8th Avenue here and look around the station, have a cup of coffee, shake hands with the programmers that you hear every day on your daily commute or when you're waking up and making your own coffee. 877-500-5266 is the number to call.
You have that Trump bump. You heard Teresa talking about it earlier. If everyone who donates monthly gives an extra $2 a month, that would increase KBOO's funding by $54,000. You support this station. It's a place where people connect with each other and connect with you. The value of this cannot be underestimated. Now's the time to do it. You've got 14 minutes left in this show, and we need you to call 877-500-5266. You are not a passive consumer of media. You are an active media justice activist. And you can do that with your pennies, nickels, and dimes. $5 a month. Very, very easy to set up and to do on a monthly basis. And it means so much to KBOO, and it supports KBOO in a sustaining way. That's the way we're able to remain independent, is because 5,000 of you are giving your $5, $10, $20, $50 a month. That allows us to not be dependent on a single corporate funder. No, we have thousands of you supporting this station. It remains independent because of that. So support that right now, 877-500-5266. Call now, 877-500-KBOO.
Well, I want to stay just for a moment longer in the in this question around Me Too in relationship to language. Because this question also reminds me of some of the writings by Masha Gessen in The New Yorker, and then also some of the writings of Miriam Gerba, both queer sexual assault survivors. And both sort of pushing for like a different narrative within the Me Too movement, supporters of the movement, but I think women who complicate the narrative. Masha Gessen talks about a split historically in feminism between a less audible and less visible sexual liberationist wing and a more dominant wing that is highly, even militantly, suspicious of sex and sort of wants to defang sex of all questions of power. And she says, in the current American conversation, women are increasingly treated as children, defenseless, incapable of consent, always on the verge of being victimized. This should give us pause. Being infantilized has never worked out well for women. And then the writer Miriam Gerba said something I found interesting about why she uses humor when writing about being raped. And she says, our storytelling habits matter, and I've listened with care and concern as a certain pattern of storytelling has come into vogue. This style saturates stories of sexual assault and violence with piety, banishing irreverence from the narrative. Stories of this sort have formed their own canon and developed their own script. According to it, experiencing sexual violence is the worst moment in a survivor's life, period. It centers violation as a baptismal experience that defines one's person and in many ways all womanhood. Because such experiences are so exceptionally horrific, the tools we use to discuss the everyday, the language we use to talk about human events, fail us. We raid the vocabulary of religion in order to confer solemnity. We quote-unquote witness a victim's pain as they quote-unquote testify. I take exception to this sort of rape exceptionalism. So I don't even know if there's a question here. Other than that, I feel like you might be a kindred spirit to some of these sentiments around complicating the narrative while also potentially being part of the movement. But I wondered if you felt any trepidation writing about a woman this way, a woman who willfully becomes an object or is portraying herself drawn to violence, and how you then situate yourself in the cultural moment.
Yeah. I did have a lot of fear. Yeah. In writing Pity the Animal, which I mentioned is the first essay I wrote in the book, I had the privilege of publishing it for a limited edition print run. And being involved in the literary community and the small press community, I genuinely didn't think that many people would read it. So I had a really great comfort in this idea that, I'm confronting something that's scary to me, that doesn't, you know, that I've made sense of by writing about, but still doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I'm still like working through it. This was 4 years ago. I was thinking this way and thinking, but stakes are pretty low. I feel like my friends will read it, and maybe some related people that follow me on Twitter would read it, and that it wouldn't make that big of an impact. So that it sounds like self-defeating, but it was actually really freeing to me. I was excited by that. I thought, okay, well, this is the first printed thing that I'll do, and you know, I'm working on this book, but I feel like I'm years away from it. I really think this is the strongest thing I'm writing right now, and I'd like to publish it. So I just felt at ease with it, but nobody read it until I turned it in to Kevin Samsel, the editor. And so I really had no idea. I didn't have any like early readers of it, and I felt at ease with it, weirdly. As soon as it was done, it was the first thing I wrote that felt complete to me. And I haven't edited it for this book. It's in the same form it was 4 years ago. And then it had a larger audience than I anticipated. It was turned into an ebook. And instead of having any negative reaction, it was mainly women writing to me saying they saw themselves in it. So I think that gave me the courage to keep writing in this realm. I think it would have been really hard for me. I would have kept writing in this realm, I think, but it would have been much harder if I hadn't had that first experience that seemed really low stakes to me. And then, as a pleasant surprise, it had a larger readership than I thought it would, and that it was mostly positive. It was mostly people saying, I see myself in this, or like, this made me think about something in a new way. And I think that's the goal of every writer, you know, to like complicate something or to introduce a new perspective to it. So if I thought, well, if that is resonating with this small group of people, then, you know, I think that I was clear enough. I think that was my main fear, was that I wasn't being clear. And people, I think, understood the complication of the argument and accepted that. Resistance to categorize I think it's like I said, I think it's very scary to go out of that box of like declaring something this or that and to say maybe it's both, maybe it's 10 different things. Like, what now? What do I do with myself if like that's the case? And I think those writers you mentioned are maybe interested in that complication as well.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Chelsea Hodson about her essay collection. Tonight, I'm someone else. Well, I want to ask you what we can expect from you next, but I'm also, at the same time, after having watched the trailer that you created for this, I'm secretly hoping you're going to say it's an album and or a film. But tell me a little bit about what you're working on.
Well, thank you. I do often fantasize about being like a Miranda July type who just does it all. Like, I just love her work so much. And I definitely would love to make a film someday, but I feel like that's very far off. But maybe someday. But
you are a secret songwriter.
I am a secret songwriter. That's true. And yeah. In doing the trailer, I'm trying to be less secret. So I went to the McDowell Colony last year, and there was a piano in my room, and I hadn't played the piano for over 10 years, maybe 15, maybe almost 20. Like, I took lessons as a child, but I can't remember the last time I was actually playing one. And it just sounded so beautiful, and like, just the sound of the piano itself. It was just this old piano, so it's very different than like the keyboard I practiced on as a child. And so it really, just having it in the room next to me and so much free time, I just started writing. So it did actually invoke like a new excitement for music for me, because I do play guitar and sing to myself, but I think I am trying to take it more seriously, and I do want to do something really soon. So I'm actively writing more songs and seeing where that goes. But my number one priority is I think like a third of the way through a novel that I started. So I'm trying to totally shift gears with my writing and try to use what I think I learned about myself as a writer through writing essays and apply it to something totally different.
Can you tip your hand a little on the novel, or?
I think I'll keep it to myself for a little bit,
because
it's so new. I don't want to change my mind and then feel like I'm bound to it because I talked about it here. But I am really interested in just having a whole new form and like a new narrator. It's been really exciting and like freeing for me.
Okay, so forgive me for just being slightly nosy, despite you pushing back. But could you name novels that you think are in the same family? How about that?
I don't think I can really. I think my main influences are movies right now and films.
What should we watch?
It's like they're not like direct references. I'll send you the wrong way. You know what I mean? So the thing that I've been mentioning a lot in interviews that I think is like my main influence, and I think definitely applies to this project as well, is the movie Under the Skin. Which is also a book, but I've actually never read the book.
I'm
obsessed with the movie because I'm obsessed with the soundtrack. Mm. And I think the soundtrack inspired the essays in a lot of ways here. And I feel like it's also inspiring the atmosphere for my novel.
Okay.
So I just see that soundtrack.
Yep. We won't hold you to this.
Yeah. But no, I'm just saying like it's still so new that I can't really fully articulate it. But I think the atmosphere of that film, I think, will apply to anything I do in the future. Like, okay. I love it so much.
Well, thanks for being on Between the Covers today, Chelsea.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking today to writer Chelsea Hodson about her essay collection, Tonight I'm Someone Else. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're listening to Between the Covers here on KBOO Community Radio, where every dollar matters. We're challenging our monthly sustaining members right now to increase their monthly donation amount by $1 or $2. If all our monthly donors give $1 more, that would be an extra $27,000 a year for the station.
Woo!
If people give $2 more a month, that would be $54,000 more for the station. Pick up the phone and put in those numbers, 877-500-5266, to increase your monthly donation or become a sustaining member. Thank you for keeping KBOO going. Again, the number to call is 877-500-5266. We've just got 2 minutes in Between the Covers to raise the goal for this show. We need you to call right now, 877-500-5266.
Thank you, Jenka. I'm Brianna, and you're listening to KBOO. Just heard Between the Covers, beautiful author interview. And if you don't know, KBOO has been here in your community for 51 years. We've been providing you with an alternative source of news, of media, for 51 years. So if you are listening right now, this is your opportunity to help become a part of our legacy. Call 877-500-5266. And if you donate $25 a month, You can get a very nice KBOO hoodie to keep you warm for the winter. 877-500-5266 is the number to call, or you can go to kboo.fm and give a donation today.
Even though your local newspaper might have been bought and paid for by a mega corporation from some other place, your local TV station has been consolidated and syndicated, your community radio station is still here. We are here, we're strong, we're independent, only because you dug deep and you decided to support this work. We're out there on the front lines of struggle. KBOO has been there since the civil rights movement. KBOO's reported from the heart of the movements, the anti-nuclear movement, global justice movement that shut down the World Trade Organization. We were embedded in the Occupy Portland, Occupy ICE encampments. Live streaming Black Lives Matter. We sent a reporter to Standing Rock when that movement challenged the oil pipelines with direct action. We are there because of you. If you don't support KBOO, this little sliver of the airwaves could disappear and you would hear dead air or even something worse. We need you in order to support this station. Radio is essential. It's a lifeline. Call right now, 877-500-5266. Come on, $25 a month. You give more than that to a cable service that isn't even useful. You give more than that to your streaming music services that don't provide the diversity of music that KBOO does.
You spend more than that on coffee and cigarettes a month. I know you do.
Come on, just support KBOO with a little bit. And that goes a long way. 877-500-5266. Dig deep right now for community radio and be a hero. 877-500-KBOO. We need your call.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bridges Cafe and Catering, located at 2716 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Bridges Cafe and Catering is a restaurant and catering company located in Northeast Portland on the corner of MLK and Northeast Knott Street. Their kitchen is about 75% organic, open daily. Lunch was provided by Por Que No Taqueria, located in North Portland at 3524 North Mississippi Ave. Por Que No Taqueria has been serving Portland since 2005 and has been committed to both the communities and the food that they serve. More information online at porquenotacos.com. Dinner was provided by Scotty's Pizza Parlor, located at 2128 Southeast Division Street in the Hosford-Abernethy neighborhood of Portland.